Welcome to Suffolk Matters, where Suffolk County meets the men and women of Suffolk AME. News, opinions, and insights you won't hear anywhere else. Filling in for AME President Dan Levler, AME Vice President Nick DiBello.
Good morning. I'm Nick DiBello, Vice President of Suffolk AME, and my guests today are Denise Coyle, Assistant Coordinator of Special Education, Fallon Daugherty, Early Intervention Office Designee, and Jennifer Delia, Assistant Coordinator of Special Education. They work for Suffolk County's Department of Health under the Early Intervention Program. For those who aren't aware, the Early Intervention Program is designed to identify infants and toddlers who have developmental delays or disabilities. This group of women provides services as early as possible to support the growth and development of children. So I want to kick it off to you ladies right now. I want to have a conversation about the work that you do, but I think it's important for our listeners to know who you are. So Jen, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to the county.
Sure. So I actually started in working in early intervention back in 2005 as a provider in the field, working with the families in their homes. My background is in special education. I also did evaluations with the families, and I often presented at the meetings at the county, going over the results of the evaluations and discussing progress on students that I worked with. Because of this, I got very familiar with the EIODs over there, and they did make me aware of a county test to take for the EIOD position. So I took the test in 2018 and luckily got the position and started at the county as an early intervention official designee in 2018. And then 2 years ago, I had taken the test for the supervisor position, the assistant coordinator position, and have been working as the supervisor for the past 2 years.
Excellent. Denise?
I also started by working with children, infants, and toddlers in their home environment as a special education teacher. In addition to being a special education teacher, I am also a licensed behavior analyst. I happened to see the test online, an announcement, and I took it. And I got the position of a special education provider. That job was both as an early intervention official designee and as a provider of early intervention services. When the test came out for just solid early intervention official designee, then I took that test because I knew I was just going to be too old someday to be crawling around on the floors with babies. After that, the test for supervisor came out. I took it, and I've been a supervisor now for about a year and a half.
Excellent. And Fallon, yourself?
So I started my professional career providing early intervention services as a special education teacher. Come from a long line of civil service workers, my mother being one of them. I took a bunch of civil service tests because who doesn't want benefits? I did eventually get hired as a social service examiner, one, by Department of Social Services. And I do really want to give a shout out to my fellow social service examiners, my brother being one of them. They basically have a tough job, although all jobs do have their challenges. They routinely are dealing with people who could very well be having the worst day of their life, and that's what they deal with. They are on the front lines, and they deal with life-threatening emergencies sometimes with regards to the fact that people can be homeless, not have food, heat, a lot of different things. So the people they deal with, they're coming at their most vulnerable times. It was good knowledge that I took back from my previous position, and I eventually did get hired in my current position as an early intervention official designee, or EIOD, we say, which is where I ultimately wanted to be.
Fallon, thank you so much for that. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand that this union represents such a wide array of membership, and we've had people from Fire Rescue Emergency recently on discussing the brush fires that have been happening out east. As far as our examiner series goes, they're often the people in this population that we represent that aren't getting the kind of attention they require in terms of just the support from the community. They do so much crucial work, just like you all do. And we're going to get more into that, what you do specifically. But I am very thankful you brought up the examiners. They do some very critical work, and we're thankful for everything they do. Denise, I would like to touch a little more on how you started and how you came here. What is so important about this program to you that makes you want to be involved with this county?
You have no idea how great, first of all, working with babies is. You know, we go out to colleges and we try to recruit providers for the field. Jen and I both do it. And it's great for the two of us to do it because we're so able to present that enthusiasm for the job and how great it is to, you know, see a child when they use their first words or to develop a rapport with a family. You end up getting Christmas cards years after you've stopped working with that family. And you know, just walking up to a house and seeing a baby's little nose pressed against the window, all excited to see you, that is just the best job in the world. And then coming here, it's an extension of that. Now we get to directly work with these families as a whole and really get their services in place and really make a difference in these child's lives.
These are long-lasting relationships, it sounds like you're having with these families.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Whether it's as a provider or even as an EIOD. We have EIODs that have been there for 30 years, 40 years, and they also have relationships with people who they worked with years and years ago.
That's amazing. So, Jen, tell us a little more about how that process works when people get involved. How do they seek treatment or help from your services at the agency there?
Sure. So there's the referral process, and a referral can be made by anybody. So we often have doctors calling referrals in, hospitals. The parents obviously themselves are making the referrals, and family members can make referrals. So as long as the parents are in agreement, they could call us, and I can share a referral line here. So people out there hear about early intervention. If there's any concerns with their child's development, you would reach out to 631-853-3100. That's our referral line. And once the family or somebody starts that process and calls it in, we then have to contact that family, you know, within a few days of receiving that referral. Once we contact the family, they'd come in and meet with one of our EIODs. They would be assigned to an EIOD like Fallon. And we meet with the family, go over the entire process. We really are the family's first face in early intervention. We are helping them through that process. A lot of families come in nervous, anxious. You know, this is their first time in this program. We want them to feel comfortable, understood, supported. Again, it's a very important meeting, that first meeting with these families, and establishing that relationship and rapport and knowing that they can turn to us. We help them through that evaluation process and choosing the evaluator. And we really are holding their hand throughout the rest of the process. We oversee, you know, once the IFSP, the Individualized Family Service Plan, is put into place with the services that the child will receive. We're overseeing that. We meet with them every 6 months. You know, in the team, we coordinate on what's going on and what needs to happen. But that referral is the first process, getting that call in.
That's excellent. And I do want to touch on later some of the challenges you have with recruiting providers. But I think for right now, Fallon, what are some of the indicators if you're a parent with a child? What are some of the signs maybe that you're seeing or delays that a child is experiencing where they think, now's the time, I need that help?
So a parent can get referred by a pediatrician, and if they have any concerns, they're not meeting their milestones, they can come in possibly for concerns with speech, OT, which is fine motor, PT, which is gross motor, any concerns with behavioral or adaptive development, which is their daily living skills. So at that point, they can call in a referral, and then we would go through the process that Jen described previously.
Oh, that's excellent. And the more I hear from you ladies speaking about, the more I know what I don't know, which is what you're all experts at right now and helping us, you know, try to explain to the community, because it is so important. I think when there's the developmental delays, that people know there's a way to get help and that they have people that are so able and willing to participate and help these children get the services they require. One of the things you had spoken about earlier, Denise, was providers. And I know there's a challenge recruiting. Can you kind of walk us through some of the challenges you've seen over the years getting providers in, whether it's the resources, whether it's people in that field, knowing that field is available to them? What are some of the issues you're seeing?
Well, the first thing is people knowing that there's a job out there. I mean, I feel like I went to work for DDI, which is Developmental Disabilities Institute, worked there, and I didn't even realize that there was a whole job out there where you go into homes and you can have these flexible hours. You can work 4 hours a week, 30 hours a week. You pick your schedule to work with these children. It's a great job. And if you're working full time, we encourage you to apply for this, and you can make some extra money on the side. Pick up one case. People are leaving the field. They're retiring. And we're just not recruiting enough people to come into this field. And again, that's why I mentioned that we recruit, and Jen and I go to the colleges to try to recruit those people. The other problem is that, you know, about 10 years ago, they changed the requirements for PTs. They used to need a master's degree. Now they need a doctorate. That really impacts our ability to attract PTs and OTs. They're going to go for those higher paying jobs in hospitals. You know, it's just natural. It's a much better job. Those who have stuck with us love the children, and they've said that. That's why they're staying with us. Another problem is they just recently, and this is going to be a problem moving forward, they just recently changed what the certification is. So now you can get certification from 3 to 21, or you can get certification for birth to age 2. Now, if you're going to school, you are going to pick that certification where you have the most likelihood of getting a job. And that's that 3 to 21. So we try to encourage people that to also get that other one. There's more classwork involved. But when we go to these colleges, we make them aware that, you know, you can get that second certification and come work with us.
So for the listeners, I'm curious, why did they create the need for two different certifications?
Not quite sure.
That's a good question. Jen, do you have the answer?
I wish I did, Denise. No, I'm not sure, but it really hurts the teacher field because that's the educational degree, that certification Denise was talking about. So when you have teachers, again, like Denise said, who are looking at, you know, the range of opportunities for a job, the position for, you know, 3 to 21 gives you a much better opportunity to find a job in that area where, you know, 0 to 2, there's less options. So it is, again, when we're going out to these college outreach programs, really getting in there and explaining the importance and how, you know, foundational birth to five is and how important it is to get in and help these kids and just how rewarding it is for us to really, you know, when you empower families, because it's not just about helping the kids, it's the parents also. You know, they need to know how to help their own children. They come to us, again, like I mentioned a little while ago, nervous, scared, you know, you have your child, you want to be able to help your child grow. Now they have this difficulty. I don't feel confident in myself to help them. We're giving them those tools so they get that confidence back. And now they know how to help their children grow. So it's such an important career. And yes, unfortunately, the salary piece is tough, and I think that's helping drive people away, but it's so much more than that, and that's why we want to try to get people back into the field.
No, and if I could just piggyback on what she said, the part about working with families, that is a key part of our job. It's an individualized family service plan that we write, so it's written for the entire family. We're responsible for educating and teaching these families how to support their children. And this program is so important because, according to the CDC, CDC tells us that between birth and 3, the connections in the brain are still able to be changed. Once you hit 3, it's much harder to change those connections. So getting in there early is so important. People really need to know that. We need providers because we need to provide services for these babies.
And I'm hoping that your appearance on the show, all three of you, will provide more awareness to the community that the services are actually out there. So there have been struggles over the past few months. And I wanted to get to Fallon on this point because she and your unit president in our world, our local union, Palmer Riley Barnes, a few months ago, we were made aware that the state made a system change to how you operate, how you input data, how you communicate with providers. So Fallon, as a union representative, as a delegate, very early on when this started going on, came to the union and said, we've got issues. We have big issues. It's negatively impacting how we're able to do our work, which means families are suffering as a result of it, and there's delays to service. So Fallon, in October of 2024, there was a new software put in place statewide called the Early Intervention Hub. Since that hub has been implemented, which, by the way, I, from learning from all of you fine people at Early Intervention, 2 years to work on the implementation of it. They had 2 years. Can you tell us some of the problems that have occurred that you tried to address prior to the implementation and maybe are still happening since?
So, yeah, Nick, we're still having a lot of issues and glitches, as we like to say. Unfortunately, the way the design is made or the software is made, it doesn't allow us to move freely through the plan that we're creating. So the current EI hub asks us to go through different panels and different tabs. It's almost like hitting the brakes when you are sitting in rush hour traffic. You're constantly hitting the brakes, whereas we used to be able to move freely through a plan. So what happens now is that it's extremely time consuming when we're writing a plan. A plan used to take a half an hour to 45 minutes on our previous software, NICE. Now it takes an hour and a half to approximately 2 hours to write a plan. For our referrals, it used to take 6 to 7 minutes to input a referral. Now it takes 30 minutes to input a referral. And we do get a significant amount of referrals a day. So the administrative burden that this puts on the EIODs as well as our administrative staff is difficult. Also, there's more room for error when we're inputting all of this information and when we're going in and out of these tabs. So It's difficult for users to navigate the system. So that's not just EIODs and our administrative staff, but also the agencies and providers that also use this program. They have issues working through the program, and they're calling us and also taking away from time that we could be using to work with our children. So the most important problem that this program has caused is the administrative burden. As I was saying, it takes away from our families. So that is the most important thing. I came into early intervention because I like to work with people. I like to work with children. I like to work with families. That's why I specifically went into this current position. Our job is to build a rapport and to understand a family's specific needs and a child's specific needs. And unfortunately, this undertaking is taking away from us being able to spend that time and build that relationship with families, being able to look at a child and have tough discussions such as, is there any red flags for possibly autism? Do we have any other concerns when a parent is coming in for something totally different? So we are losing that time.
So one of the things I just wanted to touch on, you did such a fantastic job of being so prompt about making the union aware of the issues that you were having, that we were able to jump in fairly quickly after the implementation to meet with all of you, to meet with the staff. And I think this county has tried to do a good job of giving you the tools as best they can, despite this being a statewide issue, to allow you to work earlier when there's less traffic on the system, maybe to allow you to work after hours. Having sat with your membership over there, and even I think what the listeners can hear now is the people who work in that department absolutely care about providing those services and making sure they're timely. It is crystal clear. One of the issues as a union rep is making sure that you guys aren't working at home and working at lunch, but we know because you care so much, it still happens anyway. And the community should be very much aware of the fact that you have a drive and a passion. You could hear it while we're speaking to all of you. It's so crystal clear. What are some of the ways, and Jen, I think you were a big part of this, that you've tried to combat how the system works?
Well, we had the support of Assemblywoman Jody Giglio, so a big thank you to her. She did go up and have a press conference up in Albany, and I was lucky enough to go with her to speak to the state about the issues that we are seeing with the EI Hub. As Fallon mentioned, it's a very cumbersome system. It has doubled, in some cases tripled, the workload, you know, and it's affecting timely services as well because it's taking longer to get these authorizations in. Without those authorizations, providers won't start, which is delaying those children getting, again, those very necessary services that they need. So I was able to go up and speak in that sense to be heard and have a voice up there. At home, you know, at the county, we work with our DECO, which is the Downstate Early Intervention Committee, and it's the New York City, Nassau County, Suffolk County, Westchester, Putnam, Orange County, Ulster County. It's a lot of the downstate counties. We meet pretty consistently, and even more so now with the hub, you know, launching, to discuss the difficulties that we're seeing. We then work in tandem with the rest of the state. We have NYSHO, which is the New York State Association of County Officials, and we take our matters to them, and they'll go to the state with our concerns. So we are working diligently, you know, at the county levels together, collaborating, and then bringing it up to the state. We did, as New York State counties, create consolidation proposals to try to condense and make some of these processes a little bit quicker, a little bit easier, so that we can get back to what we really need to do. Again, working with those families. As Fallon mentioned, a lot of our meetings are listening to the families, you know, being able to look them in the eye, hear their concerns. But now it's such a cumbersome system, you're sitting here trying to put information into a program where you have to go in and out of so many panels. It takes away from, you know, the plan being fluid. When you're talking about the development of a child, you are going through the social-emotional component, the cognitive component, the language component, and you kind of go in and out of those areas simultaneously because they all overlap each other. But in this new system, it breaks them up so that you can't type up that plan fluidly. You have to stop. Hold on, wait, we're talking about speech now. Let me jump into the speech component. I mean, that's just not how life is, you know? Everything overlaps. So it just really takes away from our meetings with those families. So again, we are doing all we can at the county levels to come together and again, create those consolidation proposals, which the state does now have in hand, and PCG as well. PCG is the creators of the EI Hub, and they did note that they received them and they will be speaking with us to those hopefully this month, but that's kind of where we're at right now.
And I think one of the things that's amazing is Denise has become as much of an expert on this program as you can be. And all of her free time, which I know is exorbitant with everything that's been happening, she's found different ways to try to work around the system to make it more fluid or as fluid as possible. Can you talk a little bit about the struggles you've had with not just learning these workarounds, but even having the time to train others as to how to utilize them?
Well, they really didn't give us great directions. So I had to actually go in and write an entire manual on how to use this cumbersome program. And believe me, it's 75 pages long.
It's long.
Wow.
And I had to go in and train our people. And one of the big problems when it first started was we had trained everyone on how to use the system. And we thought that they were fairly ready. And those that weren't would have been able to come to me. However, the system didn't work as it was designed. And we were constantly coming up with, okay, instead of doing this, we're going to do this, this, and this, and it's going to take twice as long, but we can get this done, okay? It got to the point where we were doing so many workarounds, you'd start to forget how the program was supposed to work. To this day, now everyone kind of knows the workarounds, and a lot of the glitches have been fixed.
Excellent.
They're not completely fixed. The speed has picked up. But now what's happening is, you know, I'm the person that the agencies have to come to, because if they're having troubles with billing, I have to go in and try to figure out how to fix whatever is wrong in their program that maybe my EIODs wrote, or things disappear. I have to figure out how to put them back in. Fallon once said at one training that they gave us, this system does not account for human error. If one of my EIODs makes a mistake, it takes hours and hours to fix, even if we can fix it. If not, we put in a ticket and we hear 3 or 4 months later on how to fix it. That impacts services. If we can't write a plan, these agencies are not going to send their people in because there's no guarantee they're going to get paid. And that's a huge problem.
Now, I would think that's a massively huge problem, because at the end of the day, in order to be able to live, you got to be able to provide for your family. So as much as these people who are providers are trying to have these careers where they're helping children, and I, again, from knowing you guys and knowing some of you were providers first, I know how much you put into it. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to afford your bills. You have to be able to live in a house, pay for your groceries and everything else. How has this program impacted the relationship between the agency and those who are trying to provide? I would imagine there's been a negative towards how many people are still willing to wait to get paid based on how this program is rolled out, which again would obviously delay children getting the services they need. So if one of you could just touch up on
it's impacting the
impact. The
agencies, not so much the providers. I mean, the providers are not going in right away, so they're not, you know, working that 1 week or two. You know, they're missing some sessions during the time. But what happens is every time we write this plan, they get new service authorizations. It's the agencies who are struggling because they're the ones that have to put in all the billing. They're the ones that don't get paid. They're still responsible for paying people. And that's a huge problem.
And if you don't mind me interjecting, Denise, that being said, it trickles down to the providers, because if they can't get that payment from the agencies, they're now going to seek other job opportunities. You know, if it's not consistent flow, you know, at some point it starts, like you said, to hit home and they're not able to support the family. So it's just a domino effect.
And if I'm able to jump in as well, it also impacts the EIODs, because if the agencies and the providers are not getting paid, they are coming to looking for the EIODs to put services in and put the authorizations through. And we are passionate and we are prideful in our jobs and we want to get everything done and we want the best for our children on our caseloads.
And I want to mention one more thing. I apologize. We've had 3 agencies completely leave the program. 3 agencies completely leave the program. So it's not just at the provider level that we can't find early intervention providers. The agencies that run that support these people are leaving. And we just recently had another agency. We have one agency that's considering leaving, another one, and then a last agency that just decided they are no longer going to do evaluations because the time it takes for them to enter those evaluations into the hub does not make it, you know, they don't have to do a whole lot in the hub. And this is, they're seeing what the EIOD see. To enter that information in the hub is just too cumbersome. And it's taking too much time and it's not financially worth it for them to do an evaluation.
It's incredible.
So that's amazing.
Absolutely incredible. With technology being what it is and having so much lead time to get to this.
Think.
Amazing. So We're getting closer to the end of the show, and I wanted to make sure you all had an opportunity to speak to what it is that you really, truly love passionately about this work, what it is you want our listeners to leave this show with. So if there's anything that you wanted to add to what we've been conversing about, now's your moment.
Again, the passion lies with working with these families. I came into this field young out of college just because I knew I wanted to work with children. And having had that experience as a provider and an evaluator really set the stage for me to now be successful here at the county level. Again, meeting these families where they are, understanding evaluations and understanding development, you know, really well, and then being able to help them know what they need to do at home and how to create a plan and what services would look like and should look like. So for me, the passion is the families. And again, I said it earlier, you know, empowering them to help their children. And again, as Denise mentioned, at this point in time, that window where brain development occurs, it's so important from birth to three. And as, you know, 3 to 5, it starts to close. And then by 7, it's, you know, the brain is not as malleable as it once was. So we really needed to get in there now. We really need providers in this field. It's so important. And these babies need us. And it's going to affect their futures. You know, like, you can help somebody now to have a very successful future, or this could be something that's plaguing them through their school career. And it's just not necessary if the right things are in place.
Absolutely. Fallon, is there anything you would like to, you know, drive home for our listeners?
Oh, these are the future leaders of our world. So we need to do what's best for them. We really want the problems with the program to be fixed so we can help our children. They are, as I said, the future leaders of the world.
And Denise, final note from you?
You know, we just want these children to reach their potential. Whatever they may be, wherever they're starting, we want them to reach their best. And that's what early intervention is all about, getting them started on that track.
Excellent. So I want to just thank Fallon, Denise, Jen, for taking the opportunity to be here today, for all the advocacy you've been doing behind and in front of the scenes to make sure the processes in place really are effective, and just so we can get right to helping children as quickly and as efficiently as possible. To our listeners, thanks for hearing us this week. Again, I'm Nick DiBello, and thank you.
If you have questions or to get a referral for early intervention, please contact the Department of Health Services Division of Services for Children with Special Needs by calling the dedicated referral line, 631-853-3100.